Our speaker today is Dr. Michael Fonseca from Carnegie Mens. Michael received all of his degrees, bachelor's, master's, and PhD in electrical and computer engineering from here at Tech, finally finishing up his doctorate in 2007. While he was working on his degrees in 2000, in 2000 he joined the Microsensors and Microactuators group led by Mark Allen and began working on wireless pressure sensors for high temperature applications. And I was going to say, in 2001, while still working on his degrees, he joined Carnegie Mens, becoming either the first or the second employee, depending on who you ask. Currently, he is, I guess, after becoming the first or second employee, you now move up the chain, and currently he is the Director of Engineering and Operations, and where he pursues new product introduction and development of wireless products for the medical diagnostics industry. He's going to tell us about
Carnegie Mens
and its products today.
Thanks. Good afternoon. I see a lot of familiar faces. I know these grounds pretty good. I've been here lots and lots of years. So my talk today should be fairly short. I'm not going to focus on a lot of technical detail. I'd like to go more in telling the story of how Carnegie Mens was formed, their progression, and how they launched their first product into the market. So it's going to be a top-level overview of Carnegie Mens, and then kind of a little bit of history and progression of product development for our first product. So here's an outline of the talk. Give you an introduction to Carnegie Mens for those of you who aren't aware of who Carnegie Mens might be, and give you some technology overview that's in the target applications that we might be interested in, specifically cardiovascular applications. Also talk a little bit about the device concept. Slight technical information here, but not a lot. And then I'll show you a little movie about what an implant procedure looks like. And this is to give you a technology overview. And then I'll go into introducing product development, which is for our first product, we spent several years developing the technology, introducing it into the marketplace, and then launching our first product. And I'll conclude. So a little history on Carnegie Mens. It was founded in November 2007. And that's about the time I was joining Georgia Tech as a grad student. Before I joined Georgia Tech, there was another student here who had been doing research in wireless pressure sensors for turbine engines. And there was some intellectual property that was developed in that research under the direction of Dr. Mark Allen. So Carnegie Mens licensed that technology in April of 2001. And pretty soon after that, once we had some intellectual property, operations began in Atlanta. Some of you might have been familiar with ATDC, that's Advanced Technology Development Center, and they were located over on 10th Street back in 2001, and that's where our office was. There's some other companies that went through that incubator space, such as Mindspring and several other companies. That incubator space is owned or funded by the state of Georgia, and they've located it right here next to Georgia Tech to try to leech out technology, develop companies that form businesses, and then generate revenue for the state through income and taxes and employment. So that's the motivation of the incubator space. Some other important information in Carnegie Mens' history was that we were located next to Georgia Tech, and that was very important for us because we were developing technology that was in the MEMS space, and that requires very specific tools that we had to use. And it was very important for us to be located next to the MRC to be able to leverage a lot of these tools to do our development and our research. Many of you that work down there have probably run into a few Carnegie Mens employees. For the positive or the negative, maybe. Several years after we started operations, we graduated from ATDC. After a while, the incubator space wants you to hatch and grow and become your own company, move out into your own space. So in 2005, we graduated and we moved to Tech Square. Very nice facilities over there. And in November of 2005, we commercialized our first product. So you can see from the time we started operations to 2005, there was a lot of work that had to be done for this company to grow and develop and introduce its technology into the marketplace. There's a new building now down North Avenue called Technology Enterprise Park, right next to Coca-Cola. And that's where we've moved to. It's a life sciences building. And there's two current companies there, Carnegie Mens and another company called Altea. And that's where we're currently located. It's about 1 or 2 miles from here. And soon after that, in 2007, we started clinical trials for our second product. And I'll talk a little bit about the strategy in the company and choosing different applications and the direction they chose to go. I would say that this clinical trial that we're currently in is probably the next biggest step in the company's history, and I'll discuss some details about that. Overall, the company's raised close to $90 million over the last 6 or 7 years, and we've grown to about 120 employees. 85 of those are here in Georgia. The remainder are scattered throughout the U.S. They're kind of a direct sales force team. So let me introduce the founding fathers of CardioMEMS. Dr. Jay Yadav and Dr. Mark Allen first started having discussions about CardioMEMS probably in 2000, and they were both interested in leveraging MEMS technology for the medical industry. Dr. Yadav had problems that he needed solutions for, and he thought that some of the technology that Dr. Allen was developing were the correct solution for those problems. So they came together and they started thinking about all the possibilities of what they could do with this company. And one of the obvious things that the medical industry needs is to be able to measure pressure. There's a lot of areas in your body where pressure is a critical parameter, and they felt like that was a very good start for a company to initiate and be able to grow and develop into various other areas. So the goal was to take some of this high-temperature turbine technology and migrate it over to the medical space. Like I said, there's a lot of different areas where measuring pressure is important, and it can help in therapeutics or in management of diseases. And I've just listed a few of them here, such as hydrocephalus, hypertension, intraocular pressure, in obesity. Now they have laparoscopic bands that can go around, and it's important for them to be able to measure pressure there as well. Urology, gastroenterology, orthopedics. And I left cardiovascular applications to the very end, because that was the main focus of CardioMEMS. There's a lot of need for pressure monitoring in cardiovascular applications, either because they're catastrophic to the patient or just the sheer volume of patients that exist that need better management. So the company chose that as the primary focus of area to start. There are some reasons for that, and I'll discuss those in a little bit. If you look at patient opportunity, so again, I'm talking about, you know, why the company is deciding to go in this space, why they're looking to go in this area. If you look at patient opportunity, you can see that at the bottom here you have aneurysms, and I'm talking about abdominal aortic aneurysms. These are aneurysms in your abdomen, usually right below your belly button. An aneurysm is a bulging of your aorta, and that's a disease where the vessel wall keeps weakening and it keeps ballooning out until it potentially could burst. And if it burst, you could bleed to death very quickly. So there's some catastrophic events that could happen to patients if they're not monitored and managed properly. But the overall population space is somewhat small compared to some of the other areas. You know, if you move up the ladder, you can see that cardiac surgery, this is for when you're doing open heart surgery. The heart, the cardiovascular system is accessible. You can implant devices at that point if you needed to. Heart failure is a disease where over progression of time, the heart begins to weaken, the cardiovascular system begins to weaken, and it's not as an efficient pump. So when your heart is not as efficient as it can be, you start to see all kinds of different side effects. You start to build up fluid in your lungs, you have shortness of breath, organs or tissue don't get all the blood that they need. And then moving up to the largest application, which is hypertension, and that affects, you know, over 65 million people in the United States. So the strategy for CardioMEMS was to take aneurysms initially because it was a disease in which catastrophic events occur, so there's a demand for product or new technology in that space. The FDA was very eager to see new technology being developed in that area, and CardioMEMS felt like that was a strategic location to start to be able to develop the technology, introduce it into the marketplace, and get its foothold in this wireless diagnostic space. And there's not a lot of competition as far as wireless implantable devices in the body at this time frame. And so it was important for CardioMEMS to try to develop technology quickly and be able to get it approved through the FDA. And in this space where aneurysms, it's called triple A's for short, or abdominal aortic aneurysms, that space, the FDA was looking for solutions. So we commercialized a product there in 2005, and that's where we introduced the technology. Currently, we're doing clinical trials in heart failure, and this is a ladder or an improvement in the market size from a business point of view as far as reaching larger patient populations, being able to develop a better technology, and overall generate more revenue for the company. So let's talk about heart failure first, and then I'll move on. It's a progressive disorder which damages the heart and the cardiovascular system, like I said, and it manifests itself in various different side effects, such as fluid in your lungs, shortness of breath, and so forth. Like I said, it afflicts over 5 million Americans. It represents about 14% of Medicare beneficiaries that have congestive heart failure. And the impact of all of this, of all these patients requiring management, is that it's about a $6 billion expense for just hospitalizing these patients. And it's one of the most common reasons for being hospitalized in the United States right now. So the estimates for 2007 for expenditure of managing these patients is, you know, close to $33 billion. So there's a lot of need for better management of these patients. In general, CardioMEMS is trying to develop technology for diagnostics. And then hopefully in the future they can start developing technology that just doesn't do diagnostics but actually provides an active role in the management of the patients, perhaps drug delivery, etc. But you got to start in one area and then progress further. And so the technology for diagnostics is somewhat limited in the medical space right now. Doctors don't have a lot of information that they can use from within the patient, where continuous monitoring is being done of the patient, whether they're at home, whether they're mobile, moving around, not just diagnostics in the hospital. So that's the technology that CardioMEMS is trying to bring and introduce. If you look at the devices themselves, the company is interested in developing miniature sensors for wireless communication. And obviously, they strategically chose to go in a passive route, but ultimately we're not going to be limited to just passive sensors. There's some clear advantages as to why passive devices prove to be useful in this area, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. So the technology itself, the sensors don't have any batteries or power sources. They're purely powered through RF energy. They're permanent implants into the patient, so there's not a lot of sensors that are permanently implanted into patients currently. A lot of diagnostics is done through scanning or imaging of patients, whether it be CT scan or MRIs, or they come into the hospital and they get acutely measured, whether that be through catheters or surgical approaches. That's how they're diagnosing a lot of these diseases. There's not continuous measurement of the patients. So for the concept itself, the way the device operates is pretty simple, and it's very easy to understand, and I've got a couple of images here that explain the conceptual operation of the device. The sensor itself is a LC resonant circuit, and most of you should be familiar with what that is. But it's basically an inductor and a capacitor. When you join these two together, they form a resonator, and it's going to have a resonant frequency. And in the field of MEMS, if you're able to fabricate these capacitors on mechanical deformable plates, now you can transduce some of that mechanical change into an electrical change. So in this case, if you apply pressure to the deflecting membranes, now your capacitance is variable in your circuit, and you can obviously change the resonant frequency of your device. So that's the basic operation. If you place your device in a loop antenna, now you get magnetic coupling. You get magnetic field interaction between the sensor and the antenna, and you're able to measure the impedance or impedance change due to this resonant circuit being in your loop antenna. So if you monitor this impedance and you apply a hydrostatic pressure around your sensor, now you're going to measure a resonant frequency change due to pressure. And that's the basic operation of the device. In practice or in practical terms, I like to use this analogy. Everybody's pretty familiar with diabetes, and in the marketplace there's commercials and devices, and a lot of work's been done to try to be able to measure blood glucose, because that's a critical parameter in being able to manage diabetes. In a similar fashion, for heart failure or many of these cardiovascular diseases, measuring intracardiac pressure or pressure inside some organ, inside of your lungs, is a critical parameter in being able to manage these diseases. So the technology is really for providing real-time monitoring of vital information, and that holds a promise for reducing hospitalization of patients, improving the patient's quality of life, and delivering more efficient and cost-effective healthcare. So I think the patients are interested because their overall healthcare and lifestyle is improved. Insurance companies are happier because they are spending a lot less money in trying to manage these patients. And the doctors have improved diagnostic tools. You know, one of the things that everybody's probably familiar with is other open-loop systems or closed-loop systems. And managing heart failure patients right now is an open-loop system. The way they manage them is they provide them medication, for example, to try to monitor their cardiovascular system, try to improve cardiac output, and improve the efficiency of how their organs are working. But they don't have a feedback loop to tell them how good or bad they're improving the management of this patient. And so CardioMEMS wants to provide a diagnostic tool, a way to be able to monitor, continuously monitor these patients. I've got a little clip here that shows you how the overall procedure is done for one of these implants. So another important aspect of the technology is that it's designed to be minimally invasive. And what that means is that you don't have to have open surgery to be able to implant the device. We want to leverage catheter-based delivery systems, which is basically either arterial or venous side tubes, for a better word, that can be inserted through your arteries, through your veins, to be able to deliver your devices in the desired locations. So for heart failure, obviously we want to measure intracardiac pressure, so we need to take the sensor and deliver it near the heart or as close to the pulmonary artery as possible. And to do that, you insert a catheter near the groin. There's probably a small incision that can be made, and this allows for a catheter to be inserted. So now you have access to the venous side, and I don't know if it's showing up very strong, but you can see here's your aorta, and there's the venous side. And I'll talk about why the venous side is being chosen in this case in just a second. So to access a site, you need to be able to guide your catheters all the way to the heart or the site of implant. And the easiest way that doctors have found to do this for this type of procedure is basically to allow blood flow to direct you all the way to the pulmonary artery. So on the venous side, blood is coming back to the heart, and then it's going to be pumped into the lungs. So what they're able to do is with an air balloon, basically generate a sail. And they'll sail this air balloon all the way up into the heart and into the pulmonary artery. So now you've accessed the pulmonary artery. And this is, I say with ease, but primarily you're allowing for blood flow to direct the direction in which your balloon is going. This is a common practice. Some of you might have heard of a Swan-Ganz catheterization. This is a procedure in which a doctor is able to do insert a catheter of this type and measure either right or left heart cardiac pressure in order to diagnose whether you have heart failure or other cardiovascular diseases. So this procedure in itself is not new. CardioMEMS didn't develop this procedure. This is something that exists out in the field already, and we're just leveraging on it to be able to access a site where we want to implant our sensor. Once your catheters achieve the site, and so you see that we've gone past the heart and we're actually in this pulmonary artery branch. And that's, in anatomy, in layman's terms, what that is from the heart, the pulmonary goes into the lungs and it just branches out into thousands and hundreds of smaller and smaller arteries. And that's ultimately what oxygenates your blood. And one of the reasons we chose this site is actually through some of the product development that we were doing at the time. Obviously, like I said, intracardiac pressure is an important key parameter for managing this disease. So the obvious question would be, well, why didn't you implant your device in the heart? And conceptually, that was the original intent. We were thinking of similar to pacemaker leads. They get screwed in into the sidewall of the heart. Usually it's... Let's see if we can go back a little bit. Let me pause it here. A lot of pacemaker leads tend to come in this area here and get implanted somewhere on this wall or down at this part. And in anatomy, this is the right ventricle and this is the left ventricle. The right ventricle receives venous blood, and then it pumps it out into the lungs. From the lungs, it comes back into the left ventricle, and then it gets pumped out to the rest of your body. So it goes out the aorta. This is your aorta here. These are the main arteries that go to your hands and to your brain. And then this main trunk goes down and it follows your spine and it feeds blood to the rest of your body. So this is, the left ventricle is really where doctors care to measure intracardiac pressure. This is the main parameter that they're trying to monitor and investigate for managing these patients. But there's some drawbacks in putting devices in this place. And one of the major drawbacks is if there's a failure mode for your device, the first place something will go to is up your artery and probably up into your brain and cause a stroke. So it's an obvious place where you want to measure, but you don't want to put your device there because you can cause serious effects. So the next best place is the right ventricle, and doctors can correlate very well the pressure from the right side to the left side. So it's equally a good spot to place a device, and that's why a lot of pacemaker leads and so forth are put here. If you generate clots or if things start to attach to your sensor and then come off, or if the device itself happens to dislodge, the first place everything's going to go is down to your lungs. If you get a clot in your lung, it's probably not as serious as if you get a clot up into your brain. Also, pacemaker leads are attached, so they got nowhere to go. For our device, because it's a permanent implant, it has no wires, it has nothing other than its own mechanical fixation to wherever you're implanting it. You need to be cognizant of some of the failure modes that can happen during implanting this device. And when we were doing product development, we said, well, one of the things that could happen is if your attachment mechanism fails, the first place your sensor is going to go is into your lung. And then we started considering, well, why can't you just measure pressure there, and is it equally useful to the patients? And so that's how we ended up developing a product that implants essentially in your lungs. It's in your pulmonary artery. It's down a second or third branch of the pulmonary artery. So once you've sailed your little air bubble all the way down to the pulmonary artery, you can insert a guide wire. And a guide wire is exactly what that sounds like. It just helps guide other devices. So you can see there's a guide wire right here. Now you're able to insert the CardioMEMS pressure sensor. It's a pretty basic delivery system. When I mean basic is we try to keep everything as simple as possible. When you're designing medical devices, doctors are accustomed to certain tendencies or accustomed to certain technologies, and they expect a certain feel for things. And one of the things that you want to do from a marketing perspective is not disrupt what they're accustomed to being able to do in a procedure, or lengthen the time of a procedure, or make them have to learn extraneous amounts of steps to be able to use your product, because they'll just stop using it. So from a delivery system point of view, the sensor, it's not easily to see yet, but it's basically attached to a catheter. The catheter has a couple of lumens in which tether wires are used. The tether wires basically secure the sensor to the catheter until you're ready to deliver it. So to deliver the sensor, it's actually pretty simple. You just pull some wires from the back of the catheter, and this basically extracts those tether wires that are holding your sensor. Now the sensor is free from the catheter. At this point, blood flow is going to push the sensor slightly down into one of the bifurcations of the pulmonary artery. And it's got some anchoring mechanisms that prevent it from going downstream too far. One of the things that you want to do is you want to prevent the sensor from going too far down a branch, because then you can block blood flow. But at the same time, you want to be high enough so you can measure the pressures that you're trying to monitor. Once that's done, you're able to extract the catheter. And now, at any given time, the patient can take readings, either from the hospital or home. So for heart failure, the idea is we want to give continual monitoring of real-time pressure for the patient. So the patient actually gets to take home an electronic system. It's a small box about a foot by half a foot, and this can sit in their nightstand. And they can monitor their pressure. They can lay down or sit up on a system that contains our antenna, and that's able to wirelessly communicate with the sensor. This information is then monitored by this box and then transmitted via wireless connection or internet to a central database that CardioMEMS houses all the patient information. And the doctors are now able to access that through the internet. So that gives them a very significant tool to be able to monitor and manage these patients. This particular product is currently under clinical trials, and so we're probably about halfway through our clinical trials. We hope to commercialize this product in 2009 and be able to provide better care and management of these patients. So obviously there's a lot of different system components that come into play in developing this technology. The obvious one is the implant itself, and there's a lot of years of research that went into developing this type of technology. But there's other areas. So when you're thinking about relating that to research that you do here, as well as myself, I experienced the same thing. You spend a lot of time researching in an area and really understanding what are the potentials of what you're researching. But in order to be able to bring that into a product or be able to market this product, there's a lot of different things that have to happen. And you've probably heard a lot of discussions that relate to developing a system and developing the device further, being able to understand its reliability, its manufacturability, and its reproducibility. So from a system standpoint, there's a lot of other development that has to happen beyond just doing the research, the pure research of how the sensor operates, how do I improve this design, and so forth. There's a entire telemetry system that had to be developed. There was a catheter system that had to be developed for this device to be implanted. There was a procedure in the medical field that had to be understood and then developed to be able to implant the device. There's a whole information technology that had to also be developed to be able to manage that information and then transmit it efficiently back to the doctors. So the next part of my talk here is kind of going to go into an example of the first product that CardioMove developed, and discuss a little bit about the progression and the different things and activities that had to occur to be able to go from a research project that myself or a previous student was doing here at Georgia Tech and transition it over to the product or a medical field. So the concept itself for wireless pressure sensors is not new. It's been around for a long time. In fact, most ideas today are not. It's hard to come up with new ideas today. A lot of ideas existed way before we were here, and our job is to figure out what are better ways in which we can implement these ideas. So back in 1967, Collins published a journal paper for implantable sensors for physiological parameter measurements. And these are very small, handmade, passive LC resonant circuits that he was implanting into the eye of rabbits to measure ocular pressure. And so he was able to demonstrate early on the capabilities of this technology. It took a long time between this technology, which he was doing, he was winding these coils by hand and mounting them on these polymeric membranes to create these devices. It took quite a while for this technology to reach the MEMS side, and MEMS stands for microelectromechanical systems, where they started looking at using silicon membranes and solderable coils to develop wireless pressure sensors. And over several years, from the 1980s to the 1990s, that technology was developed until Dr. Allen and his group started developing some of these devices for high temperature applications, in which they were looking not just at the concept itself, but how do you reliably make a passive resonant circuit operate in harsh environments? You know, turbine engines are operating at very high temperatures, and there's not a lot of things you can put in there. So that really limits your design space into what kind of circuitry you can put into your device and what kind of materials you can use. And they came about with a concept that leveraged ceramic packaging technology, which obviously, if it's ceramic, it can withstand certain temperatures, and this concept to be able to design a sensor. And so some of the key parameters in that, some of the key aspects as to why that's advantageous, are the device ends up being self-packaged. You know, many of you might be developing either circuits or MEMS components on silicon ICs or other substrates, and there's usually not a lot of concern for what the packaging needs to be of these devices. Mostly you're focused on the operational performance, how can I improve it, or maybe the process in developing these components. But when you want to take a component to market, or when you want to try to sell it, you got to try to package it. And so you've probably heard a lot of industry talk about, well, you got to develop packaging, and packaging is very important. In this concept, the critical thing is that the device is built on its packaging substrate. So a lot of those are joined together. A lot of the difficulties that come with taking a device and finding a suitable package for it are eliminated by being able to just build it on your actual package material itself. So from the initial conception, there's a lot of work that has to be done. Some of that work was done here at Georgia Tech, and you look at understanding the fundamental principles of the device operation. So there's electromagnetic effects of the device. You've got a passive LC resonant circuit operating now within its packaging substrate, and this is now immersed in a lossy media. So there's some electromagnetic effects that are happening to this device which are going to alter or change the behavior of your device. And for a product to really exist, you can't have drift, and you can't have a lot of these side effects that happen that most of the time you're not that interested in as far as doing research. You care more about understanding the fundamental physics of the device, not how does that impact the product. There's obviously some mechanical modeling that has to be done of the device. You can develop an analytical definition, and then you can create circuits to try to model all this. This is a lot of the fundamental research that was done here at Georgia Tech to be able to understand conceptually how these devices perform. Then comes fabrication and fabrication technology. So, you know, in 1967, the concept of these wireless sensors was being conceived, but at the time, they didn't have the telemetry, they didn't have the computer or processing power that we have today, and they obviously didn't have the fabrication technology that we have today. So another important aspect in being able to develop this technology was the availability of new fabrication technology. And most of you are familiar with MEMS and microfabrication, which is a product of the IC industry. Being able to use batch fabrication and a lot of semiconductor processing to create small mechanical and electrical devices. That really allowed us to miniaturize the devices that we're trying to implant. So the last aspect of the design that I want to discuss, which was important in being able to transfer this research into a product, were some of the advantages in the design. When you're talking about implanting sensors either in turbine engines or in a human body, both are equally harsh environments. Turbine engines get very hot, and it's very difficult to create devices to operate in there. The human body is no less forgiving. You have a chemistry that's operating in there. You have to be biocompatible. Obviously, you can't do any harm to the patient either. So that really limits the space in which you can operate. And what the founding fathers thought was an advantage in this technology was the sensor itself is primarily very simple. You have an LC resonant circuit. So you don't need a lot of materials. You don't need a power supply or batteries. You don't need active circuitry to be able to design and fabricate this device. And that's very important because it gives you a lot of stability in the design as far as performance. You know, one of the things that we care to minimize is the drift rate of these devices. Obviously, all transducers drift, and it's how much can you limit that drift of the transducer. So for applications where you're looking at implanting in the body, you're not going to have access to be able to keep calibrating your transducer over and over and over again at will. You really have to design a lot of stability into the device. So with the concept of the pressure transducer being so simple, it allows you to really build in a lot of stability and a lot of reliability. So passive really means that you don't have batteries, you don't have IC circuits, you don't have a lot of complexity. While it buys you a lot of features, it also generates a lot of complexity of things that could go wrong. So for an implant that's going to last for the rest of your life, the last thing you want to do is to have malfunctions or poor operation of your device. Like I demonstrated before, MEMS fabrication really gave us a lot of options in terms of what we could fabricate and how much we could miniaturize the device. And then wireless is obvious. For it to be useful in the medical field and for it to be used as a diagnostic tool, it needs to be wireless. So that leaves the telemetry system, and the majority of the complexity as far as how the wireless system works is contained in the box that's outside the body. And that's great because from a technology point of view, you can keep upgrading this as much as you want to. You can replace it. It can break. You can develop new models while the implant itself fundamentally hasn't changed and it has a high reliability and lifetime for the patient, which is critical. So to develop from research a product, there's a couple of things that had to happen for CardioMEMS for our very first product. Obviously, there was the concept, and in literature, you can go back to the 1950s or 1960s to find examples of this type of technology. But like I said before, they had limited fabrication. They had limitations in their telemetry. So then there's the scientific research, and if you look at the first product, we had to leverage essentially two PhD graduate work that was done here at Georgia Tech, intellectual property here at Georgia Tech. That amounts for about more than 10 years of work that was done here at Tech, looking at the sensor technology and developing that technology. Once you have some of this, you can go into what I call initial product development. And I call it initial because this technology didn't exist in the market space. There was no passive wireless medical telemetry systems out in the market space. So not only did we have to develop the product, but we also had to carve out that technology and introduce it into the marketplace. So in the initial product development, you're doing very fundamental definitions of, for example, frequencies of operation. We had to carve out a space in the FCC and say, well, this in the FCC, this is where our medical industry is going to operate, you know, in the 30 or so megahertz range. We had to develop specs for the sensor, the telemetry, and the catheter so that they would all work together. None of this existed at the time, so that had to occur over a period of time. And then you could actually move into more general product development where you have very specific needs and very specific targets that you're trying to meet. You can develop the product itself. And that translates to really into a lot of bench testing and process development. Because you want to sell a product, you need to understand its manufacturability, you need to understand its processes, and you need to be able to reproduce the results that you demonstrated either during research or initial conception of the device. And then comes the rest of the burden that's applied to a medical device company, which is proving safety and then achieving approval. So if we were producing cell phones, we could stop here and launch our product. But since we're trying to operate in the medical space, there's a lot more work that has to be done to be able to commercialize a product. And that involves product safety. That could be biocompatibility, MRI safety. You know, a lot of these patients need to have imaging done on them. The last thing you want to do is have this device be under such huge magnetic forces that it could tear tissues apart. Defibrillators, you know, now you can go to malls and they have these automatic defibrillators. If something happens, they might use one of those on you. You don't want your device to impact that, as well as you don't want those types of systems to impact your device either. SAR, that specific absorption rate, that's basically avoiding microwaving your tissue. So we have to ensure that because our system operates in a frequency band that we're not radiating RF energy that's going to damage any kind of tissue in your body. Then you have animal implants where you try to leverage safety concerns such as safety concerns localized to the implant itself. You look at the tissue around the implant and you look at, you know, are the animals getting fevers? Are they showing any signs of adverse effects? And then finally, you're able to go into clinical trials, and this might start outside the United States and then transition into the United States. So it's a long period of time between just developing the concept and the device and then being able to market it into the product. So once you've finally achieved FDA approval, now you can commercialize your product. So I'm going to go quickly through an example of our first product, and that was for abdominal aortic aneurysms. The problem itself is that the aorta, which is right in front of your spine, right here in front of your belly button, there's a disease in which this vessel weakens and it balloons out. So the treatment, you have two options for treatment. One is surgical, in which they implant a graft. The other one is non-invasive, in which they implant a stent graft. And this is done through catheters, in which now you have a new lining. And the purpose of this treatment is to block any blood flow into your aneurysm to minimize its expansion. So obviously, CardioMEMS was interested in this kind of treatment because it's minimally invasive. That expands the number of patient population that you can treat. And so once you have your sensor implanted next to the stent graft, you can monitor this aneurysm over the lifespan of the patient. So our goal was to be able to be a diagnostic tool for an existing treatment. Some of the problems with this treatment, and so what was the need for CardioMEMS to create this diagnostic tool? Well, this is a preferred method of treatment because the doctor can surgically implant this graft. The problem is the surgery itself. A lot of these patients are elderly. They have other complications, and so this is a very traumatic surgery for the patient. This is a lot less traumatic, and so there's a lot more patients that can receive this treatment, but it's not perfect. It has other problems such as leaks, either in the graft itself or other vessel walls feeding the aneurysm. So there's a lot of potential for this aneurysm to keep growing. And that really drove the FDA to find new technologies to be able to monitor these patients. So I've created a very simple matrix here, and it's not a complete matrix, but it gives you an overview of what I talked about before. You know, you need to be able to bench test your product for many different things, whether it be performance to its catheter because it needs to be delivered. There's other things that products need to be tested for, such as ship testing, shelf life testing. It needs to be sterilized in order to be sterile, so you got to validate that whole process. And then there are electrical safety aspects related to that. For a medical device product that's implantable, you also have to look at biocompatibility, and so there's a lot of predefined tests that your product has to undergo to be able to meet the guidance regulations. There's a lot of animal studies that need to be done, and then finally there's human studies. For this particular device, we looked at an 84-patient pivotal study, and we had 12 sites in multiple countries. And up to date, we've had up to 4 years of follow-up since the first implant that we've ever had. So I generated kind of a very basic timeline of what it took for us to go from an idea that Dr. Yadav and Dr. Allen were conceiving to the point where we launched a product. And there's this initial part, what I call initial technology development, where you're carving out that space for an entirely new product or a new device that doesn't exist yet in the marketplace. And so there's a lot of work that's going on in either developing the sensor, developing the delivery system, understanding the medical device aspects of the product. And then you do the product development, where you do some of the trials, and then finally you can launch the product. And I've listed here launch of a second generation product because I want to show how the cycle time quickly improves once you've done all this legwork and you kind of define the foundation for a new industry. Once you do that, you're able to quickly leverage on everything you've done in the past to be able to generate a new and improved product or products for other spaces. So in the beginning, I showed a slide that had various many different pressure sensing applications. Now we can leverage this to be able to develop that technology. We don't need to skip. So here's a summary of the product development. As I mentioned before, you know, the initial research was started back in the late 60s, and then it continued at various different institutions, including Georgia Tech. Then it went on to new technology development, where we had to introduce and develop the technology for a new market space. And then we went into product development. And I want to emphasize that for product development, obviously you have to have a prototype, you have to have the device and the concept figured out, but that doesn't end the work. And usually that's where you end most of your research projects, is once you've achieved the conceptual, the prototype, and the functionality of the device, once you've characterized it, whether it be a process or a device itself, that's normally where you end. But for product development, you must continue, and you have to do design optimization, process development. Manufacturability becomes important because there's been a lot of very creative and neat designs for MEMS devices out in the world, but one of the major flaws they have is that they're very difficult to manufacture, or they're such complex devices that it would be very difficult, or it's a barrier to get those to market. So design for manufacturability becomes very important when you're thinking of research projects that you would like to commercialize later on. Like I mentioned, there's product safety and performance that has to be understood. And then finally, you're able to commercialize your product. So that concludes my presentation for today. I'd like to thank all of you, and I'd like to thank Dr. David Gottfried for inviting me to speak at the seminar. Thank you.
We have time for questions. Is it normal for a company of your size to market the products themselves, or is it usually that the technology is licensed to a bigger company?
I think in the medical industry, what happens is some of the bigger companies end up consuming a lot of the smaller companies. For CardioMEMS, their strategy is twofold. One, they do all their development, so they hire all the engineers. You know, for the medical aspects, for the electrical engineering on the telemetry side, And for the engineering on the sensor side, you know, we've got probably 20 or 30 engineers all in each space working to develop the technology. They want to understand the technology. So we don't farm out the design. Then another strategic point the company did was they went into hire their own direct sales and marketing team. And that was to be able to precisely control the marketing and distribution of the product. So I wouldn't say that it's common, but for our industry, it seemed like a very good strategy to be able to market our own product and get our own direct sales force, as well as design. Well, the only thing that we do farm out is the manufacturing of it. Once we've developed the processes, we don't manufacture it ourselves. We contract manufacture most of the manufacturing steps. And that's, I think, a common trend nowadays is to outsource foundry work, such as MEMS devices, out to foundries, just because of the capital that's required to create a clean room and so forth.
Speaking of capital, you raised $90 million over a period of 5 or 6 years. What were your sources of it? Were there any governmental sources?
No, it was all private funding. I'd say about half and half between venture capitalists and then private companies and their research and development sections of the private companies interested in our technology and wanting to fund our work. So there's been very limited government funding. Most of it's been private funding. One last point on that. It was important, and I didn't mention it, but both Dr. Jay Yadav as well as Dr. Allen were previously experienced in startup companies. Dr. Jay Yadav created AngioGuard, which was sold to Johnson & Johnson, and Dr. Mark Allen had Radion, which was a microneedle company that was acquired by BioValve. So both of them having experience in generating startup companies was critical in the initial stages of being able to raise capital and grow the company to what it's become today. As far as how we test our sensors, there's lots of different testing that we have to do. There's a testing for design validation when we have a new concept, and then there's testing for the product itself. Each device is basically measured and calibrated uniquely. So each device has a calibration curve for that transducer that's generated, and each patient then gets that information to be able to monitor their sensor that translates frequency response to pressure. Well, the testing is all done as part of the manufacturing process as far as performance testing. So functional testing, you know, frequency to pressure performance and so forth. There's a lot of in-process testing that's done to ensure quality of the product as well as ensure functional aspects of the product as well as the final what we call the calibration code of the product, which specifies for that specific transducer what its response is going to be. Once you implant it in the patient, there's very minimal amount of testing that's done, or what I'll call testing. There's a calibration that's done to set the mean pressure, but as far as the sensitivity of the device, that's not affected. So that's all measured ahead of time during the manufacturing process. Did that answer your question?
Okay. Along those same lines, for maybe in situ calibration, now that you've done clinical trials partway or maybe halfway, have you noticed or can you comment on the life expectancy or the change in calibration over time, you know,
Yeah, there's a lot of different aspects that we had to consider in the design as far as, you know, what's going to impact the performance of our device. And I just mentioned a few, but there's, because it's an RF system and it's got parasitic inductance and parasitic capacitance that could be coming from anywhere, we have to shield the device, electrically shield it from that environment. So, you know, blood and saline are very lossy media that can really increase the amount of losses in your LC resonant circuit, and the main drawback to that is that you won't have sufficient energy being transmitted and absorbed by the sensor because of all the losses that are surrounding it. So that's one aspect of it. Then there's endothelial growth over the device. For our particular device, I didn't mention this before, but it's actually silicone coated, and that's silicone, not silicon, and that's a polymer where a lot of these tissues really don't want to stick to. So there's not a lot of, what we've noticed with all our devices from the very beginning is that there's not a lot of growth that wants to stick to. There's not no clots or anything forming on them. And then lastly, what you look at is, since it's a pressure transducer, if you do have growth or tissue that covers your deformable membrane, you want to make that very rigid or very stiff in relative comparison to what could grow on your sensor. So our membranes are mechanically very stiff. We only deflect in the matter of micron or submicron ranges because it's so stiff. So some of the gaps that we generate between these capacitors are under a micron for some of our devices, just to make it so stiff that anything that could grow on it would not alter its performance in that sense. I think there's a question over here. Yeah, did you have a question?
Yes, how were you able to manufacture this product so that the body wouldn't reject it? And if you're, another thing that I was wondering about for hypertension, if you're inserting something into the arteries that are clogged, what type of effects would that have on the person?
So the first question was, how do we make it so that there's no adverse effects to the implant itself? First step is to just choosing the right material set. There's a list of materials that have been known to be biocompatible already, and so obviously you want to choose from that list. And then you need to make sure that any combination of those materials don't have an adverse effect on the patient as well. So you go through a lot of biocompatibility studies. And animal studies to look at tissue reaction, or extraction studies where you're looking at, what's coming off. Is there particulate? Is there bio burden that's attached to my devices in manufacturing? But the first step is obviously choosing the right materials. And for our devices, they're made of fused silica. That's pure glass, basically. Glasses are very biocompatible. They're very stable materials. And as I mentioned before, the device is manufactured into the package itself. So the glass that is the sensor, is the package, and it's also the mechanical structure that's pressure sensitive. It's all united and integrated into one. Then it's coated with silicone. That's a very common implantable material. And so that's how we ensure that it doesn't affect the patient. As far as clogged arteries, I'm not really sure what your question is. You mean, would the device cause clots, or if the arteries are already clotted? Yeah, I guess if I understand the question correctly, for the abdominal aortic aneurysm, for example, which is, it can be a sac as large as my fist, so it can grow very large. When they put in a stent graft, the stent graft itself is basically new piping for blood flow to happen. So once you occlude or you exclude this aneurysm from blood flow, things start to coagulate, things start to get, not solid but not blood either. It's kind of this in-between state. And so the sensor that we implant there happens to be in clot and blood and other body fluids. But because it relies on hydrostatic pressure, it doesn't really matter that there's soft tissue or these other things. Ultimately, the hydrostatic pressure surrounding it is going to make that membrane deform. So it shouldn't really affect it.
Give me further questions. I'm sure Michael will answer them afterwards. So let's see if it's approved.